Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life. Because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, and also featuring some video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. It's got a brand new episode out, or excuse me, issue out right now, featuring New York Times best-selling author Dr. Judith Orloff, just written a book called The Ecstasy of Surrender. Great interview with Dr. Orloff. Also, Seattle's own Peter Mountford, an up-and-coming novelist, very talented young guy. And, somebody else I've forgotten, even though I didn't edited the interview. It'll come back to me. Anyway, it's up now, and it's awesome. You can find it at authormagazine.org. Oh, I know who it is. Molly Weisenberg, author of Orangette, a great food blog, and also a restaurateur, a stellar restaurateur. It's gotten a great memoir out called Delancey. So that's the third interview. Anyway, you can find it all at authormagazine.org. And finally, we're funded by the Great Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. Coming up on our 60th anniversary, you can head on over to pnwa.org if you want to learn about them or their upcoming yearly writers conference. It looks to be another good one. Should be another good one. So that's that. So, you know, I say, you may have heard me say it before, but what it takes to write the book you want to write is what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. And it's really true. So, for instance, a book, you begin with an idea for a book. You have your own idea for the book. You think you're going to write about a girl pirate, and then you might end up writing a space odyssey for some reason. And this is a lot like life, how you might go in to college to be an actor and wind up being an electrical engineer. You just never know, but you have your ideas. So today's guest knows about change and about these sorts of changes. Will North, charming and generous Will North, is a Seattle writer, or Seattle area writer, I should say. But once upon a time, he was a policy wonk down in Washington, D.C., in the Carter administration, the Clinton administration. But somehow this led to fiction writing, which literary fiction writing, not just fiction writing, but literary fiction writing. And now this has also led recently to mystery writing. So how does a person do that? Go from wonkiness to literature to mystery? Well, we don't have to wonder. We've got Will with us today, and we're going to find out. Will, welcome to the show.
Bill, thank you. It's wonderful to be here again.
You know, Will, I want to get to the wonk part, because it was a very interesting part of your life. But before we even get to that, Will, I want to go back farther, what I believe is farther than that. And I want you to think back over your life. When did the idea that stories matter to you first light up in your mind? When did you first notice stories and notice that you cared about them?
I know exactly when that was. It was in my eighth grade English class in junior high school with a teacher called Margaret Daskaly. And we had to read the long narrative poem Evangeline, which was about people up in, let's see, do I remember correctly, Nova Scotia or New Brunswick being shoved down to New Orleans. Was it Longfellow? I think it was Longfellow wrote it. Anyway, we had to write a substantial essay, and so I did, and we all did, and she passed all of everybody's papers back after she'd reviewed them, but she didn't pass mine back. And I thought, oh, dear, I'm in it deep this time. And she stood up in front of the class. This is a true story. I'm not making this up. She said, I always give two grades, one for content, meaning the thought process, another for style, meaning grammar, syntax, and whatnot. Right. I have here a paper to which I've given three A's, one for content, one for style, and one for something I can't explain to you.
Ooh. Oh, it's delicious.
And I get goosebumps every time I tell that story.
Man. Wow. And now that is fantastic. Eighth grade was when I first really knew for sure I wanted to write also. I had written a short story for my English class, and it was well received. But my question to you is this, Will. Do you remember the experience of writing that? Do you remember anything about it lighting up as you were doing it?
Not a clue. Not
really?
A clue. I just remember being humiliated in the class with everybody going, ooh.
All right. Right. So it's so
I wanted to crawl into a hole and pull the rock in after me, you know.
But yet you stayed with this writing thing. Despite the
I had a couple of other really good teachers who kept telling me, keep going. Keep going.
Wow. That's awesome. And so you kept going. Now, as I mentioned in the intro, you spent some time down in D.C. If anyone's listened to – I did an audio interview with Will a bunch of years ago, maybe 3 years ago. We talked about this some, but maybe we have some new listeners here. And you were a ghostwriter for a time down there. Is that correct?
Right. Initially, I worked in the Carter administration, which sort of gives away how old I was, although I was ridiculously
you were
young.
Just a pup. That's right.
I was. It was, you know, it was terrifying, but very, very rewarding. And then the best thing that ever happened to me almost in my entire life is that Ronald Reagan was elected and he fired me because it was a political appointment.
Sure.
And I had to choose what I was going to do next. And the first, you know, in some ways I didn't even have to choose because a think tank came along, a research institution in D.C., and immediately asked me to research this one subject and to write an accessible book about it, which I did. And I kept doing that for various foundations and think tanks for almost a decade, cranked out these highly accessible books about public policy issues. And then I finally... It occurred to me that the only thing occupied was my head, that my heart was not really in it. I was good at it, but I don't think I really cared that much. And I couldn't see, this is the key point, I couldn't see the work that I was doing actually hitting the ground and affecting people's lives.
Even though technically that's what they wanted to do with it, right? I mean, that the whole idea behind a think tank, theoretically, is to try to change policy and all that, but you couldn't feel that.
I couldn't feel it. And at the same time, during that same period, I wrote three off-the-beaten-track guidebooks to Britain, the place that I had up until I moved out here, was the only place I ever felt at home in my life, and they were very well received. And I started getting letters from people who were using them for their vacations, and I realized I'm actually affecting people.
Right.
They like
this. It's profound.
And that was a big change.
No, it's profound as a writer, even though you do – now you know because you're writing fiction now, and you've got to go into your cave and talk to your imaginary friends, and you're so in your own world. The experience of having a stranger read your work and in some way be affected by it, I can't ever get tired of that, I don't think.
Well, some of the subjects that I've written about in my fiction affect people because they're very personal subjects, and I get sometimes some really heartrending emails, fan mail from people who seem to really have been affected by the story that I spun.
That's great. Well, then you've done something.
In between there, there was that ghostwriting period.
You ghostwrote for Bill Clinton? Is this true?
And also Al Gore, as well as a number of other people. I was trying to get away from D.C., but it was like D.C. was flypaper I couldn't shake free of.
Yeah. Well, did you ghostwrite for Clinton while he was still in the White House or before then or after then?
While he was still, it was the end of his first term, I had already written a book for Al Gore called Common Sense Government. And Clinton really liked the book, and he liked the voice in the book, and called me, I don't know, maybe it was a few months later, and said, I want you to come back here, and I got this book that I want you to help me do, and I need to have it in 3 months.
Wow. Whoa. And you did it. How interesting that must have been, man. Well, you know what's cool about that?
I tell you, working with him, you know, I got to spend about an hour and a half or 2 hours with him in the Oval Office once a week for not quite 3 months, but the guy was just a delight to work with.
Yeah, I believe it. I believe it. And what I think would be interesting and valuable about that for a fiction writer is this, and tell me if I'm wrong, but so much of what fiction writer does, it seems to me, is get beneath the surface. And of course, our experience of Bill Clinton, although we've learned a bit about his personal life, but our experience of him is through the filter of media, and it's a very surface sort of narrative about who he is as a person. But you got to go beyond that and experience him as a human being, and so see the difference between reality and then the surface perception of things, which to me is so much of what the fiction writer is trying to do, is dive beneath the surface of things. Does that make sense?
It does, and it helped that he and I don't mean to compare myself with the former president of the United States, but he and I had very similar family history, troubled families. We had to be the grown-ups in our family long before we should have been, and we understood each other.
Yeah, that does help. And now let's see. So when I interviewed you a few years back, you had just published Waterstone Heart,
which was my second novel.
Your second novel after Long Walk Home. The Long Walk Home. And now you recently released Season's End. From Book Trope Editions, congratulations, novel number 3. But you're not done, are you? You've got a new chapter.
I got a little bit of a backup.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I've started killing people. It's it's a lot harder than you might think.
Yeah. Okay. So you've gone from writing literary fiction to a mystery. Is it going to be a series?
It is.
Okay, so what?
It's a series that's set in the series is set in Cornwall, England, which is a place I adore and that is full of magic. That's the only way I can put it. That far southwestern tip of England is first of all covered with Stone Age, Bronze Age, and Iron Age sites. Everything from intact Iron Age villages, which of course have eroded, but they're still there on the landscape, to megaliths, to stone circles, to burial quoits, to one thing after another. And in addition, there's also because it is at the end of the line in that country, there's also a long-standing tradition of what I would describe as witchcraft, but in the lightest form that you might imagine. Really, they're called village wise women. And I put together a team of advisors on both the police procedural side and also among archaeologists and several witches. And every time I have a factual question, they're there to answer it.
So witches, witchcraft, this is not Wiccan. This is not Wicca. Is this something different?
It's called the old craft. Wicca is actually quite new. It's only been around since about 1950 or thereabouts. It's amalgamation of other pagan ideas. But they are not very different.
No. The old craft dates back to the pre-Roman times, back to the age of the Celts and all that.
At least that far, and possibly much farther.
Yeah. Wow, England's so cool. I saw something on archaeology, and they said in America, archaeology's in like the science department, but in England, it's in the history department because for the English, archaeology is just history because they're sitting on it.
It's completely true. I remember my very first trip to England back in 1969. I was standing in a pub. The ceiling was so low, and I'm so tall that I could basically wedge myself between the ceiling and the floor. And I realized the pub was older than my own country.
Wow. It's still there. All right. So you've written books set in England already. When you're setting a mystery series there, but I know why you like England, and it's such a moody place. It's awesome in that way. But why mysteries? Why did you make the switch over there? What prompted that?
For a very simple reason, I have always loved reading them. And I'm going to go back to the very first experience I had with them. I was, maybe 12 or 13. I was often ill as a boy.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere along the line, somebody gave me the complete stories of Sherlock Holmes. And in one of those stories, I believe it's The Sign of the Four, there was this one sentence that just transformed my way of being in the world. And that sentence is, when you eliminate everything that cannot be, whatever is left, no matter how improbable, must be the truth. It's basically the principle of deductive reasoning.
Right.
And suddenly, I could make sense of the world as a kid. You just get rid of the stuff that doesn't make any sense.
So that transformed it for you. Because up to that point, did the world seem more... how old were you again? 12, you said?
Oh, 12 or 13, I think. Yeah.
Okay, and so... Chaotic. Oh, so the family that you were in was chaotic, and you were looking for some sense of order, some sense of meaning and continuity. And you found it for the
first time. I wanted to know how to make sense of the world around me.
Right.
And how to weed out the stuff that didn't make any sense.
Yes.
So to continue with the answer to your question,
wow.
Ever since then, really, I've been a fan of British mystery writers. I'm thinking of those from the so-called Golden Age between the two World Wars, Dorothy Sayers, Niall Marsh, Marjorie Allingham, people like that. And then, I don't know, there was a break, and I started reading more contemporary British murder mystery writers like P.D. James, Ian Rankin, and also two Americans who write British murder mysteries, the most obvious of which is Elizabeth George, who's a perennial New York Times bestseller.
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact is reading my new mystery, even as we speak.
Oh, yeah, well, she's a Seattle. She's in the neighborhood here, isn't she?
Yeah, she lives on Whidbey Island. Also the hilarious Martha Grimes.
Yes, that's who I was thinking of. She is hilarious. Yep. She's great.
Yep.
She's great. She is. She's just. I loved interviewing her. And so here's an interesting contrast. Martha Grimes doesn't know one end of an outline from another. She can't deal with it. She doesn't know. She begins and she just takes off. Now, how about you? You're writing mysteries. Do you outline them?
No, and Elizabeth George is the complete opposite.
She outlines
everything. I have never been able to outline for a couple of reasons. One is I tried it once, and it felt like a straitjacket. And the thing that gives me so much joy in writing fiction is that I'll sit down in the morning, and I have no idea where I'm going to end up at the end of the day. And every couple of minutes, there's a surprise. A character shows up out of nowhere. A scene describes itself, and you just have to write it down. It is such a joy. And knowing where I'm going makes that sense of surprise impossible.
Yeah. Now, you see, I think that's fantastic, but some people cannot live with that uncertainty. It just makes them too nervous. And so they've got to at least convince themselves that they've got a plan, whether they stick to it or not. But you have no problem with that uncertainty at all, it sounds like.
No, and that's true. When people ask me, you know, what do you need to have when you want to become a writer, especially a fiction writer? And I always say two things. You need discipline. You need to be able to sit down and do it every single day. And you need courage. You need the courage to just allow things to happen that you didn't plan on.
Yeah. Well, and really, every writer I know talks about the surprises, talks about being surprised, and often that's the stuff that really electrifies the story. The stuff that came through that you really hadn't planned on at all, and that's often the stuff that is so genuine. It's so authentic.
That's right.
You feel like you just found it, right? You just found the stuff.
You don't find it. It finds you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, that's what you know.
In my new book, Season's End, I think it's maybe on the fourth or fifth page, a character shows up, a really irascible elderly woman who is also partly clairvoyant. And I had no idea she was going to be in the book. And this is like on page four or five. And she tries to steal the show, actually.
Right. So you must have had some vague idea of what the novel was before you dove in, even though you didn't outline it. You must have had some idea of what you were writing about. Or didn't you? Maybe you just had a character?
Well,
how did you start?
Typically, I always have three things. One is setting. And setting is really important to me. It's like one of the most important characters in a book. It's the place. And people who write to me about my books say, I don't have to go there. I've already been there now that I've read the book. Second thing is I might have one or two characters, maybe three. And finally, third, I have some theme that I'm interested in exploring. I sometimes don't have a real clear idea of what that theme is, but it becomes clear as I work. And in the case of Season's End, I moved to an island in Puget Sound. I live on a beach upon which I'd say 98% of the houses are lived in only during the summer season. They're essentially vacation homes for rather wealthy people. The more I learned about the people who live here, the more I realized they've been coming here for generations. Two, three, four generations have spent their summers from the 4th of July to Labor Day on this beach, long, expansive beach. And one day I was standing, as I am as we speak, looking out the window from my office, looking down this lane that runs along the beach, looking at all of these houses, which at present are empty, and thinking, okay, so here's all this family history. How could that end in a single Labor Day weekend? All of it.
That was the question.
Every family.
Wow.
How could that end? What series of betrayals would bring all of that history to its knees?
Now you see,
and
what's
the
so
book,
interesting
the
about
book actually begins. The book actually begins with a scene that actually happened to me. It's not exactly as it's shown in the book, but I was driving along on the island really early, just barely, not even dawn, and down this long twisty road, driving too fast as usual, and in the middle of the road, I saw a mass. And at first I thought it was a deer. And that, in fact, that is the first line of the novel, Season's End. At first he thought it was a deer. It turned out to be a body.
What? This is true? This happened to you?
It did.
Holy
and, thankfully, the body was alive. It was a woman who was not very effectively attempting to commit suicide because of an argument with her boyfriend, and I think she was also quite drunk.
She was just laying down and letting you run her over? Is that the plan?
Yeah. Well, as Bill, as you may know, I'm a New Yorker by history. That's where I grew up.
Okay.
And so as a wise guy New Yorker, I'm looking at this woman lying in the middle of the road on the double yellow line, and I'm thinking, lady, if you want to commit suicide, get off the double line and get in a lane.
Right. Hey, you should have given her some advice. Wow, so that's
I helped her up, and actually happened.
Yeah,
and it happened quite some years ago, and it just, that notion, at first he thought it was a deer, I just couldn't shake free of it.
Yeah, well, that's a great boy. It's great. Hey, we've got a caller who'd like to ask you a question, actually.
All right, then.
Jeff, is that you?
It is, Bill. Thank you so much. I know you're really quick for time, so I'll try to say this as quickly as possible. Well, great interview. Real fan of your work. So glad you made your nom de plume Will North and not Oliver, but that's just my political band. I'll move on. I want to take you back, if I can, to if I pronounce her name correctly, Mrs. D.S. Coley's eighth grade class, when she asked you to write that critical essay and you got those three A's. You have a great quote on your website, Will, that says, "When you know with absolute certainty that you're a totally worthless speck in the universe, I'd learned there was something I could do better than anyone else, I could write." So my question to you, Will, is how does that early epiphany speak to your writing today?
It is a great question. It gave me courage. When you're in the eighth grade and you're a boy, and I was actually one of the shortest boys in the school at the time. I'm now 6'5". Yeah, I was. And, you know, you feel like nobody. And this is a junior high school that was also attached to the high school, so you are even more of a nobody. And then suddenly I realized, hey, there's something I can do. There's something I can do maybe better than other people. And basically, I've been living off of that belief ever since.
Yeah. You have...
I'm very lucky that after Ronald Reagan fired me, and this is now almost 35 years, I've been able to make a good living as a writer, and that's my day job.
Yeah. That's awesome. That's awesome. And so you're able to get up every day and say, how am I, and ask the question of yourself, how am I going to communicate with the world? Even if it's on the paper, but you're asking, what can I share with everybody? Every day you get to ask yourself that question.
That's right. It's as if you're on an adventure and you want to say, I wonder where we're going to go today. And I wonder if anybody else is going to be interested. Let's just give it a try.
Have you looked upon your life as an adventure? Have you felt like it's that way, or did it feel like something you were having to sort of get through? Has it felt like an adventure to you?
It has. I have always believed in jumping off of cliffs, and I really mean that literally. I've had quite a number of career changes. Each time an opportunity came along, you just had to take a deep breath and jump, and so far, soft landings.
Yeah. But but just like a book, just like that's when you think, how could all this come to an end? When you see the career opportunity, there's something has to. I think this is so important as we lead our lives. Something lights up in you, and you recognize it and honor it, and you pay attention to it. You know what I'm saying? I mean, there's something.
Sometimes it's seriously risky. It might be risky for the economic health of your family. It could be any number of risks. But there's something that you just can't not do it, because the one sure way to fail is to not try. You try, you got about a 50-50 chance of succeeding. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So try.
Well, because it is your life. It is your, it's not someone else's, this is yours, this is your experiment. You wouldn't let someone else write your book for you.
Right, and nobody is in charge.
Although
you did
it for someone else. That's right.
Well, yeah.
That's right. But that's a little different. All right, so you may have already answered this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, Will, because we only got a couple minutes left. Finish the sentence for me. If writing has taught me anything, it has taught me what?
To listen to my heart.
Oh, to listen to my heart. And that's what you've been doing all this time, isn't it?
Especially after I turned to fiction.
Yeah, it's the only way to do it. Well, what a great answer. Well, Will, thank you so much. Thank you so much. Good luck. Season's End is out now. And
correct.
The first mystery, which will be called...
Harm None.
Harm None will be, well,
it's
we don't, I,
the first
can,
in the,
can you say
the,
when it'll be out?
It'll be within a month.
Oh, okay, very soon, great. So Harm None
first
in a month?
In the Davies, it's the first in the Davies West mystery series. Those are the
awesome.
Names of the two main characters.
Well, Will, thank you so much. Best of luck, and I hope we get to chat again.
Thank you, Bill, I hope so too.
All right, take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Well, follow your heart, people. Your brain cannot tell a story. It doesn't know how. It really doesn't. But the heart does know what belongs and what doesn't, when a sentence is right and when it's not. It's all you've got. So follow your heart. Next week I'll be here with one of my favorite people, Holly Robinson. What a peach. So I'll get to talk to Holly. But until then, do what you love. Love who you love. Write what you love. And you really can't go wrong.